When I met Phil, he was a lunatic classical composer.
Jerry just out of nowhere sat me down in one of their booths. He said, "Hey man, I want you to play bass in this band. I know you don't play the bass. I know you can do it." I said, "Okay, Jerry." And I was just stunned because the whole world just opened up. Podcast, a journey through the world of classic country music with your hosts, Chris Wainscott and Jim O'Malley. We will be covering all of the great topics in country music, from mama to prison, to dancing, to drinking, to guitar picking, to all the crazy deal with the devil, honky-tonking stuff you do on Saturday night, and how you try to get it past your Lord on Sunday morning. So climb aboard the cart and let's go.
October 25th, 2024, the world of music lost one of the great ones. Born March 15th, 1940, Philip Chapman Lesh would take the world by storm 25 years later as the bass player for the upstart Bay Area band, The Warlocks. Upon learning that another band was already using that name, The Warlocks found themselves needing a new moniker, and thus was born The Grateful Dead. From 1965 until the untimely death of de facto leader Jerry Garcia in 1995, you would find Phil standing resolutely on stage holding down the bottom end. After the Dead's long strange trip came to the end of the road, Lesh carried on in various incarnations of his band Phil and Friends, as well as several reunions of some or all of the surviving members of the Grateful Dead. We at the Hayride would like to express our deepest condolences to the Lesh family.
Grateful Dead co-founder and bass player Phil Lesh is born in Berkeley, California in 1940. When he enters the College of San Mateo 18 years later, he is a violin player and a trumpet player. He's so good on trumpet that he is the first chair with the San Mateo Community Orchestra. He begins to study at the University of California in Berkeley, and later on, he studies trumpet and violin with Italian modernist Luciano Berio. This is a graduate-level program at Mills College in the Bay Area in California. Around 1962-1963, Phil is working as a recording engineer at radio station KPFA. He is heavy into classical and kind of experimental symphonic music. Again, trumpet, a little bit of violin. He is writing his own musical scores at this point. And when he's working at the radio station, he becomes friendly with a banjo player who's a big folk and country and bluegrass guy, a guy named Jerry Garcia. One of the few common elements between the two men musically at this point is older blues music. Think of the Chess Records era, Muddy Waters, Willie Dixon, Howlin' Wolf, Slim Harpo, people like that. By 1964, Jerry Garcia has become friends with a young guitar player named Bob Weir.
Out in the West Texas town of El Paso, I fell in love with a Mexican girl. High time would find me in Rose's Cantina. Music would play and Felina would whirl. Black in the night were the eyes of Felina, wicked and evil while casting a spell.
And a blues singer, harmonica, and piano player named Ron McKernan. They used to call him Pigpen.
I'm a little schoolboy too. Come on now, pretty baby, I just can't help myself. You're so young and pretty, I don't need nobody else.
And like a lot of young bands in California around 1964, you saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. You saw the Hard Day's Night movie. You kind of got hooked. That was a big part of the motivation for these guys to pick up electric instruments and start a rock and roll band that they were calling the Warlocks. They needed a bass player, and Garcia approached Phil Lesh. And, you know, I think this is one of these little marvelous, weird, unexplainable phenomena in the universe, where you go with a guy that didn't play bass, didn't want to play bass, not remotely interested. And then the fellow becomes one of the great innovators on the instrument. Three of my all-time favorite bass players fall under that category. You have Paul McCartney, who, you know, they had three guitar players. George was better. John didn't want to play bass. When Stuart Sutcliffe left the band and passed away, before they had the recording contract for Love Me Do, you know, two guys looked at Paul and said, "Tag, you're it." In my own musical experience, a fellow named Mark Baierly, best guitar player in the band, very graciously, we needed a bass player, and he was the best qualified to jump in and learn on the job. Great. Phil Lesh is that third guy. He's a trumpet player who's doing avant-garde and symphonic music. He's in a graduate program to perform and study. He's that good. And all of a sudden, you've got a friend who's a banjo player and a friend who's learning guitar and a country music fan. And you have a big fat guy who's an incredible harmonica player and a blues personality, not just a singer. Ron McKernan was just a huge personality. And you get this symphonic trumpet player and say, "Hey, man, we need a bass player. It'll be fun." Sure enough, it was fun. Phil is incredibly innovative through the 1960s in an era where, you know, in a lot of early rock and roll, the bass player is just kind of keeping a beat. He's sort of a guitar version of the bass drum and complementing a little bit of what the left hand of the piano player would be doing. But before the Beatles, there was still a lot of piano in early rock and roll. In the 60s, with Paul McCartney, with Phil Lesh, with Jack Bruce from Cream, and one of Phil's favorite bass players and teachers early on, the wonderful Jack Cassidy from Jefferson Airplane, these guys really struck out. And, you know, some of that, maybe some of that comes from, you know, I was a horn player, or I was a guitar player, and I got drafted to be the bass player. And I'm not content to just sit there on the root note and go thump. So you get these guys that are incredibly melodic. You know, when you listen to Cream with Jack Bruce, he's, you know, keeping the beat, he's solid, but he's kind of all over the place. And by the time you get to the end of the 60s, the other bass player that emerges with a real melodic sense is Roger Waters with Pink Floyd. So, you know, early on, it's McCartney and James Jamerson at Motown who are doing this. Then you get Phil, and you get Jack Cassidy, and you get the blues influence, but you get that symphonic influence as well. In guitar magazines or in interviews, when asked about his style and his approach to the bass, Phil would very often say that he approached it like being a brass section, you know, being the trombone, kind of filling that role in terms of the rhythm and the structure of the music, but he's coming at it from a brass or a horn point of view, and incredible sense of melody. Very often the Grateful Dead would cover basic old rock and roll stuff. Big River by Johnny Cash, Round and Round, you know, the Chuck Berry classic. Land, another Chuck Berry classic. And you'd think you're going to be getting the usual, you know, boogie woogie Chuck Berry kind of bass line, and you are. When it's time to get back to the one, you know, Phil is right there. But in between, it's almost as if he's playing one long composition that just happens to be the bass line in a cover version of a Chuck Berry song.
Terminal zone. Put your engine to cool your wings and let me make it to the telephone. Los Angeles, even Norfolk, Virginia, down water for 1009. Build a boat back home, this is the promised land. Call it in the floorboards, my home.
And the guy literally learned on the job. And typically, It's the bass player who serves as the bridge between the two guitar players in this kind of rock and roll band setup. And in the Grateful Dead, it's Bob Weir who really enjoyed the term counterpoint guitar player more than rhythm guitar player. But it's really Weir who's serving as the conductor and kind of the bridge between Garcia, who also had a background with trumpet aside from banjo, and Phil, you know, with a solid trumpet background. And those guys are playing melodic parts. And then you have Weir in the middle as kind of the chord structure, the bridge to link those things together.
Oh, that's true.
You didn't do She Never Stumbles.
We only did two verses before
the You did two verses. I did the second one, and then you did the instrumental. You used to do the third verse.
Right, well,
then we did
we'll have to do this.
One of the finest examples of this in a nice, quiet, acoustic music setting, you can go on YouTube and find it super easy. It's around 1990. And it's Garcia, Weir, and Phil sitting between the two of them. They do this wonderful cover of a Bob Dylan song, She Belongs to Me.
She can take the dark out of the nighttime, paint the daytime black. You'll start out standing, proud to steal her anything she sees. You'll start out standing, proud to steal anything she sees. You'll wind up peeking through a keyhole, down upon your knees.
And it's one of the finest examples of the role that each guy plays. Garcia's playing a very folk country kind of melody part. Bob Weir's playing these kind of very large McCoy Tyner influenced chords in his wonderfully usual way, unusual, more accurately. And Phil is creating this wonderful melody throughout that kind of holds everything together. It's a lot more than you would expect from one bass player in a rock and roll band with guys that look more like a bowling team than rock stars. Incredibly unique approach to the instrument. As a singer, that's kind of a whole different story. Early on, the Dead were more of a dance band, an acid-tinged experimental dance band. And around 1969, they start to listen to a lot of their friends. Their friends happen to be Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Crosby especially, good friend of Garcia and Weir. They start to get more into the idea of songwriting and traditional storytelling and kind of get away from the half-hour, 40-minute versions of freaky dance numbers. And one of the things that happens in 1970 is several of the band members, including Bob Weir and Phil Lesh, lose their parents. They're getting to that point in life where their parents are passing away. And this becomes one of the signature musical stories and events in Phil's musical career.
Baby, the sun is shining, birds are. The lyrics came about in an unusual way. This was the first time I had written a song in a long time, and I worked out the melody and the chords, and in fact, the whole song from beginning to end,
the introduction and a little coda and everything. And I put it on a tape and gave it to Hunter.
He'd just written these lovely changes and put them on a tape for me, and he sang along. Do 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 da do 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 ba da da da. So the phrasing was all there. I think I went through it two or three times, writing as fast as I could, and that song was written. And it was written for, I guess it was written for a young man whose father was dying.
And at that time, my dad was dying of cancer, and I would drive out and visit with him in the hospital and also at the nursing home that he spent his final days in. And after Bob gave me the lyrics on the way out there, I would practice singing the song, and it sort of I identified that song with my dad and his approaching death.
What do you want me to do for you to see you through? A box of rain will ease the pain, and love will see you through.
The lyrics that he produced were so apt, so perfect. It was very moving for me to experience that during the period of my dad's passing. I felt like singing it in other situations similar to that since then.
His father is dying of prostate cancer. Oddly enough, something that would affect Phil in the later years of his life. But he's driving from the Bay Area out to the hospital, you know, on a pretty regular basis to spend the time with his dad. And he's trying to think of a way to communicate and to share his feelings. It becomes incredibly popular and well-known throughout the Grateful Dead catalog. But it has kind of a life beyond that. Because the song so incredibly addresses the feeling and the experience and what you go through when you're saying goodbye to somebody you love and they're dying and you don't know what to do. And they're not exactly sure what to ask you for. So what you offer is more of a feeling than a specific thing. It's tough to describe because there's so much emotional content in the 5 minutes of the song that it really has taken on its own life as this way to express the unexpressible. between a child and parent, siblings, any kind of loved ones. It's just one of those perfect songs to capture one of the most difficult experiences we have in our human relationships. And I think it's really fitting that, you know, you have a man that created the song originally to say goodbye to his father. And now here we are. Phil was 84. He passed away this morning. I think it is incredibly appropriate and well-deserved that the man's emotion and musical talent and just the passion of it, that the song kind of now go back as a message, not from him, but to him.
Get down this boat. There's nothing that you can say. It's just old Luke, and Luke's waiting on the judgment day. Well, Luke, my friend, what about Miss Anna Lee? Said you'd be a favorite boy. Won't you stay and keep Anna Lee company?
Take a load off.
But that attitude of we're just gonna, you know, blaze away and it's either gonna fly or it's gonna crash, meh, so be it, we'll try again tomorrow. That's a great attitude, provided that as an audience member, you get to go enough times that you see the flight more than you see the fire. So yeah, by the mid-80s, Phil is contributing again vocally, and every once in a while, the audience would kind of start, you know, let Phil sing, we want Phil, and it would become this chant. And in the first couple of years that I was going to see them, and at first, I wasn't really impressed the first time I saw them. And I went back a few more times, and in 1986, there was a weekend up in Wisconsin at Alpine Valley where on Friday night, it was Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers backing up Bob Dylan. And then Saturday and Sunday was the Grateful Dead. And that was a good time. By the spring of 1987, they've got a bunch of new material in the works. Jerry Garcia has recovered from a diabetic coma and started to clean up his personal habits. And from 1987 to 1990, they kind of have this wonderful second golden era.
Black Muddy River, roll on forever. I don't care how deep or wide. If you got another side, roll Muddy River, roll Muddy River. Black
that I don't think there's just me. I think most people would tell you that it's really on par with what they were doing from 1969 to 1973. You know, they were mostly healthy. They had a piano player that had been around for a while and was contributing a lot to the band. They had a nice batch of new material. They had done some tours with Bob Dylan. They'd been collaborating with other people. Clarence Clemons from the E Street Band was playing with Garcia a bit. Branford Marsalis, another great horn player, was coming around now and then. And that period, it was just fantastic.
She was a gift to travel at the speed a room of flies. These wheels are bound to jump the jacks before they burn the tires.
any improvisational thing, whether it be theater or film or a bunch of musicians, you know the risk you take being part of that audience. When it's good, oh, holy geez, you know, you got 20,000 people who think they're sitting on the moon together having a good time. There's a real nice garage band or kind of punk sentiment within all that, you know, and I think it goes back to the old bluegrass festival mentality. Everybody, you know, in town got together. It's a county fair type atmosphere. I never met that guy, and this guy's never met that guy, but we all know how to play Blue Moon of Kentucky. So, hell, let's see what happens. It's a wonderful tradition in, you know, in theater and music. Bring your talent, bring your passion, bring your friends, strike a match and see what the hell happens. And for 30 years of the, you know, that proper Grateful Dead lineup with Garcia and Phil and Weir, Mickey Hart and Bill Kreutzmann on drums, in the long run, I think they succeeded more than they failed.
An interesting fact to me about Phil as a musician, and this is a story that was in one of the band's books. I don't remember if it was Bill Kreutzmann's or Steve Parrish's or whose book it was, but one of the band members was telling this story in their book that they had met Phil through a friend at a party, and Phil could do this parlor trick where he'd turn his back and he would invite a guitar player to play any chord they wanted. And Phil would be able to identify exactly what it was. I mean, he had perfect pitch. So you could, you know, we had guys trying all kinds of weird chords and Phil nailed every one of them. So, you know, to me, he definitely escapes that sort of trope of, oh, you know, he's a bass player. He's only the bass player. He must not be that good of a musician since he just plays bass. Everyone knows the good musicians, you know, et cetera, all that crap. But the truth is, Phil was not playing the bass solely as a rhythm instrument. Phil managed to play lead bass while also holding down the rhythm of the song.
Stay much longer, Melinda. The sun is getting high. I can't help you with your trouble if you won't help with mine. I gotta get down, I gotta get down, gotta get down to
You talked about Phil and his enjoyment and love of classical music. One of the things that I got from Phil's book was his love of Charles Ives. And I myself You know, obviously we've talked about rabbit holes time and again on the podcast. I myself did a rabbit hole and listened to an awful lot of Charles Ives works after I read Phil's book. And, you know, I'll tell you, my music collection went from nothing by Ives, because I didn't even know who he was, to I probably have four or five CDs of his now, of his compositions. The man was an incredible composer. Wait. Another interesting musical fact about Phil: as a bass player, he not only was trying to perfect the technique of playing the instrument, but he was really pioneering an awful lot of electronics when it comes to the instrument. In fact, for anyone who's seen the Grateful Dead movie, there's a clip of Phil, and he has this bass which looks like it has maybe 30 knobs on it. And he's talking about the various effects he can get from this. Now, by the time that I was seeing Phil, and I first saw Phil in 1994, I only saw the Dead three times. I saw Phil many, many times after the Grateful Dead. But I started seeing Phil in 1994, and by then he was already playing six-string bass, and I remain incredibly impressed by so many times where I saw the man just go to town and take a song somewhere that you wouldn't expect a bass player to be able to take it.
One of the weird non-business things that the Grateful Dead were famous for was encouraging and allowing people to record their concerts. Again, this goes back to the old Bluegrass Fest tradition, something Garcia was interested in, but you did not have to pay extra for your ticket, and you got a nice little roped off section right by the soundboard and the lighting crew from April of 1987 until that last concert with Jerry Garcia in July of 1995 here in Chicago. I was lucky enough to record the band right around maybe 60 times or so. Being part of the recording little subculture within the subculture thing in Grateful Dead world, I learned a lot about microphones and field recording technique and portable recording equipment. And boy, just the advances from the late 80s until now in portable recording equipment. It's, you know, like reinventing the space shuttle. The technology and the kind of equipment you can take around now, it's pocket size. It's just amazing. And I learned how to be a younger person without a ton of experience, to be around older people who had been recording for a long time, who had been part of professional sound crews, and you learn to shut up and watch and listen and learn, and then, you know, you have a chance to kind of share that later on. You know, this is probably a good time. When I first started out doing this, I would have to give a lot of thanks to a fellow named Steve Fukawa, who's retired and out in Las Vegas now, but way back when, that guy was a hell of a patient and good teacher. And all the people that I've suckered into, hey, you know, help me carry all this heavy equipment and stand in line for an hour doing nothing. You get to do both things and listen to me bitch about it while we're doing it. There's a long list of people. At the beginning, it was Steve McCormick and Joe Kinsella and Barry Dredzy, and the guy that's been doing it for over 20 years now, and we don't do it so much, but Chris right here, and then our friend Ben Bridger, who we kind of adopted from one of those Save the Children programs and brought him along for the ride. It's I learned a lot about recording, about music, about equipment. And, you know, most of the close people in my life are people that I've met because of music.
For anyone who's not aware, Phil was the recipient of a liver transplant. And he felt an obligation to honor the young man who saved his life, whose name was Cody. By every night, Phil would go on stage and he would talk about, you know, how he had received the gift of a second life by receiving a liver when he needed it. And he would implore, you know, the crowd to please become organ donors. In fact, there were some runs of shows at the Warfield in San Francisco where Phil had actually signed a bunch of organ donor cards as a witness and given them to everybody at the show. So he was very serious about spreading the message of organ donation. Every Phil and Friends show, and then every show by the Dead or the Other Ones or whatever the band was calling themselves at whatever point in time, to kick off the encore, Phil would do what was known as the donor rap, where he would just ask everybody to please consider becoming an organ donor and saving lives, and that he felt so grateful that he had had a second chance at life. So, you know, I want to mention that I really think if there's anyone out there who's thought about becoming an organ donor, but you haven't yet done so, you should register and become an organ donor. Tell your family what your wishes are as far as that goes. And to take us home, here's Phil doing the donor rap.
Well, thanks, you guys. I don't know, but I thought that last set was pretty extraordinary. Thank you for joining us and helping us make that music. You know, without the energy that that you bring to our gathering, our communion, none of this could ever happen. And we wouldn't all be feeling so good at the end of it, you know what I mean? So God bless you. Thank you so much for helping with that. It's so important. I mean, it's essential. And as always, though, it's a bittersweet moment for me when I get to play the music with these great players and in front of wonderful audiences like you. I'm a liver transplant survivor. I'm lucky to be alive at all today. If it wasn't for Cody, who saved the lives of 8 people, including me, I've never seen my kids grow up. I never would have met my grandson. I never would have been able to do all this. So I owe Cody a lot, and I try to honor his courage and his generosity of spirit. By asking people whenever I can to turn to someone that they love and that loves them, and just say to them, hey, if anything ever happens to me, I want to be an organ donor. And it's family what counts in situations like that. So, I mean, that's all you really have to do. And then it's set. It's set for time. You know what I mean? So God bless you all. Thank you for listening.
Across the Rio Grande, across the Lazy River, across the Rio Grande, across the Lazy River. Thank you.
if you are a person whose health and beliefs line up with being an organ donor, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful way to stick around and help somebody out at the same time. So, you know, again, if this is something that lines up with where you're at, please do consider this. It's, you know, it's the gift that keeps on giving. That's cliche, but that's what it is. In the summer of 1989, on a beautiful Wisconsin evening at Alpine Valley, the Grateful Dead brought back a lovely old gospel standard called We Bid You Goodnight. And at the beginning of their career, Phil was a tenor. And by the end, and as Chris pointed out, you know, by the end of his performing career, Phil's voice kind of drifted somewhere between Bob Dylan with a cold and Lou Reed with a worse cold. But when they brought back the We Bid You Goodnight gospel number in the summer of 1989, I was one of the folks there to record it, but Phil had developed this lovely baritone. And again, just one of those moments where you're glad you were there. So thank you, folks, for listening and being on the hayride with us. Thank you, Phil and Garcia and everybody else that has gone on to the great beyond at this point for the music. Good night and good luck.
Lay down, my dear brother. Lay down and take your rest. I want to lay my head upon your Savior's breast. I love you. Oh, Jesus loves you the best. And I'll bid you good night. Good night, good night. Lay down, my dear brother. Lay down and take your rest. I want you to lay your head upon your Savior's breast. I love you, but Jesus loved you the best. And I'll bid you good night, good night. Good night.
For some people, small, beautiful events is what life is all about.
Hello, country.
I'd like to remind you to email us at sixstringhayride@yahoo.com. Six is spelled out. You can also search us on Facebook as Six String Hayride. Or what we'd really appreciate you doing is finding us on Patreon under Six String Hayride as well.
Well, folks, thanks again for joining your hosts, Chris Wainscott and Jim O'Malley, on the Six String Hayride Classic Country Podcast. We are here for all of your classic country, rockabilly, early rock and roll, little gospel, little blues, a lot of excellent country music-themed recipes, and basically, we are here to keep your musical circle rockin', boppin', and very much unbroken. So thank you for sticking with us. We will see you down the road real soon. And again, whether it's in your home, in your community, wherever it is you do your thing, keep your circle unbroken. Stay well, stay safe, and we'll see you real soon.
Oh, can the circle be unbroken by and by?
I'm gonna join the family circle at the throne. No, the circle won't be broken by and by, Lord, by and by.
Remember, the Force will be with you always.